double the air pressure in there. I suspect that instead of breaking down at 30,000 volts, it'll take 60,000 volts to break down if you double the air pressure. And why air behaves that way, oh, it is a beautiful piece of science as to why it does that. High pressure air is a very good insulator. Low pressure air is a fairly poor insulator as far as high voltage breakdown is concerned. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the tech net.
WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, we used to make them as when I was a kid. And you could take them and turn them upside down and they wouldn't go anywhere. Or you could have it running, going up and up the ladder. And you could take a piece of paper, put it in between the two. And it would just ignite the paper. It would sit there. It wouldn't keep going. It would keep burning through the paper. And then as it burned through the paper, it would start rising higher and higher and higher. A lot of fun. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, John and I both own a wind test machine. And our wind test machine is something that looks like two great big plastic phonograph records. It looks like it, but they're made out of clear with a bunch of tinfoil contacts on it. And you operate the handle on this machine. It can generate well over 100,000 volts between its two probes. And so it's kind of fun. That's a wind test machine. A Van de Graaff generator is another one that can make some very high voltages. And so, in your case of your Jacob's ladder, it looks to me like you had a lot of fun with that. Your particular Jacob's ladder, Paul, was that a commercially made product, or did you homebrew it with something like a neon sign, a high voltage transformer? Tell me about the Jacob's ladder that you built or owned, and describe its components. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I was probably a teenager. I was probably broke.
Comment.
I wouldn't buy anything. Somebody had an old neon transformer, so put out 13,000 volts and took two coat hangers. You know, just kept the straight part and put it into a piece of wood, you know, 2x4, about an eighth of an inch apart, and made contact with the metal, and off it went. So, and it was probably about no higher than a foot high, but it would get about maybe 10 or 11 inches. It would never make it to the top, you know. And the top was probably about 2 inches apart. But it worked good. Amazing. You could have a lot of fun with the old neon transformers.
Okay, a person said comment. Please give us your full call letters, your name, and go right ahead with your comment. K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. The name here is Nick, November India, Charlie Kilo. Call sign is November 2, Hotel Victor Romeo. I have a Windhurst generator. You were mentioning pressure, but also humidity, because I noticed that when the humidity is high, I can't barely get a spark to jump between the two electrodes. Yet when we have very low humidity, I can open the electrodes an inch and turn the generator and spark across. Back to you.
Yeah, if you study the passion curve and the other information about high voltage breakdown of air, you'll find out that the air breakdown versus humidity is almost linear. In other words, a high humidity day and a low humidity day, the breakdown of the air itself is almost the same. However, a Windhurst machine, because of the way it works, will not generate high voltage on a high humidity day. So, yeah, you can't get much of a gap on a high humidity day because the Windhurst machine itself wants to be dry. It's got to be super dry to work very well. On top of that, the way you tilt the two probes, in other words, you don't just bring the two probes where the two round balls are close to each other. You aim one of the probes off to one side and aim the second probe toward the middle of the shaft of the other probe. And whether or not you do it right to left or left to right makes a big difference. The one that puts out the positive polarity is the one that you want to aim toward the shaft of the other one. In other words, a high voltage breakdown. Let me drop it. A high voltage breakdown from a positive probe will tolerate a much bigger voltage, and it gives you a much bigger snap and spark, whereas the negative lead, when you aim it toward the middle of the other shaft, you'll hear a sizzling sound, and you won't get much of a spark, you won't get much sound, you won't get much action. So there's a whole art and science to using a Wim Hof machine, keeping it dry, getting maximum performance out of it, and so on. And there's ways you can adjust the brushes on the Wim Hof machine so it gives you much higher voltage. However, when you adjust the brushes by rotating that that assembly, it's got a brush on each end. If you rotate it in the direction where you get a higher voltage, you will get higher voltage, but it has a much more difficult startup. And there's a whole procedure for starting up a Wim Hof machine. Back in the days when you had a cathode ray tube television set, on the days when it feels like not starting up, if you bring one of the probes toward the screen of a cathode ray tube television set that's running, you will prime it and it starts working. And by the way, the Wim Hof machine, let me drop it. Another crazy thing about it is that when you turn on your Wim Hof machine, today the right-hand probe might be positive. Tomorrow, the right-hand probe might be negative. If you short out the machine and thoroughly discharge it and start it up again, the right-hand probe that used to be positive might be negative. In other words, once it starts running in one direction or the other, polarity-wise, it keeps running in that direction. Your particular Wim Hof machine now, Nick, where did you buy it? How long ago did you buy it? Where did you pay for it? The one that's sold by Edmund Scientific, so to speak, is pretty mediocre in performance. There's another one that's sold by a scientific company in Buffalo that has a much higher performance. So, your particular Wim Hof machine, Nick, what brand name, what did it cost you, how long did you buy it? N2, Hotel Victor Romeo, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Also, the diameter of the wheels, that makes a difference also.
All right. Yeah, I did get it from Edmund, and yeah, it's sort of like a toy almost. I was I went through a phase when I started doing experiments with electricity, making battery, making electric motors out of a single AA battery, a magnet, a piece of wire, all sorts of crazy shit. Sorry. And I happened to pick one up. I did get it from Edmund, but it's about a, back then I think it was about $90 to $100. You know, just doing some experiments there, you know, cranking it up, you can hear the static on an AM radio, stuff like that. What I was gonna say, you know, I was just, it just dawned on me too, I work in HVAC, and whenever we would install air conditioning equipment in with Liebert units in computer rooms, it would be the same thing. We would want the computer room operators would want a humidifier in each air conditioning, so they would maintain a high humidity, and then less sparks would travel from your hand. Let's say if you're operating a board and you're removing a board out of the machine, you'd have the ground brace and the ground wire attached to your wrist. All that's the same thing, you know. With the high humidity in the room, less chance of any sparks arcing over to a chip, let's say. Back to you. This is N2HVR.
Yeah, the Wim Hof machine that John and I own, we both bought the same one from the same company. I'm not sure, but I think the wheel is around 10 or 12 inches in diameter. Does that sound about right to you, John? John, you've got one right in front of you. What's the diameter of the two wheels, the two plastic wheels? Over to you, John.
Yeah, mine's in the lab. I think mine is 11 inches thick, same as yours.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of websites you can go to and tell you how to build Wim Hof machines and so on. And almost all of them do not, of the ones you can buy, do not go beyond 11 inches. The highest voltage the Wim Hof machine will give you is primarily a function of the diameter of those two plastic wheels. You double the diameter of the plastic wheels, instead of it producing 100,000 volts, it'll produce 200,000 volts maximum. Also, there is a Leyden jar, it's a pair of Leyden jar capacitors connected to the two probes. So depending on how much voltage you put into that Leyden jar and how much picofarads of capacitance it has, determines how much energy it stores. Energy in joules is 1/2 CV². So you take the capacitance in farads, the voltage in volts, plug it into the formula, 1/2 CV², that's the number of joules of stored energy. And the machine you can buy, let me drop it. The maximum stored energy you can put into that Leyden jar is below the threshold where you can create a fibrillation problem. If you go beyond a certain amount of stored energy in joules, and you discharge the machine between the person's left hand and his right hand, and the current is flowing through his arms and through his heart, there's a slim chance that if the timing was just right, you could send the person into atrial fibrillation, I think it's called. So they make sure they keep the number of joules below by limiting the number of picofarads of the Leyden jar capacitor and the number of volts that it will generate, which is a function of the diameter of the wheels. So you could, if you want to, build one with larger wheels. And if you did that, it'll generate higher voltage, in which case you better be careful, because if you discharge it across your body in the wrong way, you could create what looks like a heart attack, if you know what I mean. Any further questions or comments on all of the above, give me your call letters and name right now, K2IW of the TechNet. Fun machine to play with, by the way. John, do you remember the brand name of the company we bought our Wimshurst machines from? Over to you, John.
Dick, I believe it was Scientific Instruments.
Okay, Scientific Instruments, and I think they were located in Buffalo, and from time to time, when you Google the word Wimshurst machine, every so often they're selling the machine at a cut rate over Amazon, and I think mine was on sale for like $60. About a year later, you bought yours, and I think yours was on sale for like $75 or so. Does that sound about right, John? Go ahead.
Yes, Dick, that was correct. I don't know if it was on sale or not, but that was the price I paid, and that was with shipping. So I think it was well worth it. And it's, even though it's plastic and wood, it's really well made, and I have it. The only thing that I'm going to have to do is replace the rubber bands, which I can get from them.
Tell me about that, John. First of all, when you and I bought the machine, I think it actually got shipped to us from China. I think it was built in China. I think it was shipped to us from China. Your rubber band that wore out, John, it broke because you used it so much. Go ahead.
No, it started to dry out, Dick. I can see there's little cracks coming. It still works well, but the cracks are starting to show up, just like you know, when reel-to-reel recorders and things like that, you start to see the rubber itself starting to part, and I've noticed that. I'm afraid to really flex it hard to see how much because it'll snap completely, so I do have to get a couple of those bands.
When you buy those bands, please buy a second set for you and for me. I wonder if when we got those bands, had we covered them with silicon grease or something like that, I wonder if we could stop the slow down the drying out process. What do you think?
That's a good question, Dick. I know they have a rubber vitalizer, which you used to use on all kinds of rubber wheels and drive wheels, things like that. It would make them supple again and prevent them from cracking. I think that might work on those belts, but when I order mine, I will order a set for you, too.
Yeah, thank you. When you operate that machine in a dark room and you wait until your eyes are fully dark adapted, boy, you see some beautiful things going on. You see all kinds of arcing and sparking going on between the individual tinfoil strips that are on the two wheels, particularly as you now adjust the position of the brushes by rotating the metal piece that's holding the two brushes. You rotate them in certain directions. You'll see various things going on. You'll see how the machine is actually picking up the voltage from the tinfoil strips that are being rotated on the discs. The spark itself, the actual spark you get when you get the machine adjusted for best high performance. I have gotten a spark on that machine 5 3/8 of an inch. 5 3/8 of an inch.
Yes.
And when you get a spark that long, and you look at the spark, every one of the sparks you get is not a straight line. See, in the case of a Jacob's ladder, you're feeding an AC voltage into that, and you get kind of a random-looking spark. When you're using DC voltage out of a Wimpfos machine, let me drop it. The spark is always a very particular kind of zigzag. Never twice the same, but it's a zigzag. Is it?
Hey, Dick?
What was that again, John?
The same as lightning.
That's a good way of putting it. It's like a miniature lightning bolt. It's got a zigzag to it. And the zigzag is because of cosmic rays, I strongly believe. I'm not positive, but I got a strong belief. The cosmic rays that are happening in your neighborhood when you're operating this thing. As I said, can you believe you can get a 5 3/8 inch gap spark? You're getting it just right. What's the biggest spark you've ever seen out of the one from Edmund Scientific? I think the Edmund Scientific one, you have quite a bit of trouble getting beyond about a half inch. Is that true, Nick? N2HVR, K2RIW. Yeah, maybe Nick is watching the debate. Or it just got called away. I know I was going to visit you to show you the ways of tuning the machine to get highest possible voltage on a dry, low humidity day. And my guess is you've never seen 5 3/8 inches. I think you've gotten well over 3 inches of gap, haven't you, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Dick, I think the measurement, the largest one I have is 4.5 inches, which impressed me. I didn't know that you've got it over 5 inches. I thought we were both around the same target. But one thing I did find, which I don't know if you've ever done, I had to clean the wheels because if I put it in a dark room and I was spinning it, I noticed that there was arcing between those plates at times. And what I did was I took some ethyl alcohol and washed those discs, and it made a difference. So I don't know if you've ever done that.
Absolutely, many times. And even when the discs are as clean as you can get them, in a dark room with dark adapted eyes, you still will see a minor amount of sparking in between the pieces of tinfoil on the discs. I think you own some of those things called blank blank snowstorm. I forget some man's name, snowstorm.
Ghostless hailstorm.
Okay. Were you able to get all of the little pitfalls inside of Volta's hailstorm? Were you able to get all those pitfalls moving simultaneously with none of them idle? Over to you, John.
Not with the wind purse machine. I would get them to extreme activity, but some of them would stick halfway up, maybe three quarters of the way up, and it was kind of strange, but I never got every single one of them to be in motion at the same time.
Just like you, for brief periods of time, I had every one of them in motion, and then later on, they start piling up along the sides of the plastic cylinder somewhere. And if you put a very small amount of isopropyl alcohol inside of that machine, just the right amount, you get a lot more activity. Put a tiny bit more than the right amount, and you get no activity at all. The slight amount of conductivity of isopropyl alcohol inside of that machine makes those things really come alive. And that's another whole experiment. Over to you, John. K2RIW.
Well, Dick, I used to use isopropyl alcohol, but because of the denaturing agents, I switched to ethyl alcohol, and I found a big difference.
Yeah, I'm guessing isopropyl alcohol has got a whole lot of water in it. Ethyl alcohol maybe has a lower water content, and the difference in the chemistry, if you got just the right amount, makes it work better. And I bet if you put too much in, it stops working. Is that true, John, even with the ethyl?
Oh, that's correct. It will perform the same way, but ethyl alcohol has no denaturing agents, where isopropyl and rubbing alcohol, all those alcohols have denaturing agents, so you can't drink it, it'll kill you. So I think it's something to do with those elements, whatever the denaturing agent is, maybe Dr. Roy could fill us in on that. That, I think, is part of the problem.
Now, is there a difference in the chemistry of isopropyl alcohol and ethyl alcohol? Yeah, I know there's two different kinds of alcohol. The alcohol that we have in our potable drinks is very different than the kind of alcohol that we rub on our skin. So there's at least two different chemistries of alcohol. Is that true, John? Go ahead.
Well, there's a couple. I mean, you have wood grain alcohol, then you have, like, alcohol and ethanol, which is made from corn. That's actually ethyl alcohol that you can actually drink. And those denaturing agents, which they've been using since the days of Prohibition, I don't know what those elements are, but I know they have, they're poisonous, and they are very close to the boiling point of alcohol, which I think is like 98 degrees, something like that.
Now, there is a kind of alcohol called denatured alcohol. What does the word denatured mean, if you happen to know, John? Go ahead.
It's an adulteration process that they use to keep people from drinking it. It's poisonous elements that they actually add to it, and that's the, they're taking it from a natural source to an unnatural source.
WS2N?
Yeah, I'll pick you up in a second, Paul. If they didn't add that agent, the alcohol that's there, would it be safe to drink if they didn't add the denaturing agent to it? Was the denaturing agent just to make double down sure that you don't drink it? Over to you, John.
Yeah, if it's not a grain, a wood grain or spirit alcohol, which will poison you by itself without any denaturing, anything that's denatured is usually ethyl alcohol. Now, the hospitals used to get drums, 22-gallon drums, of what they called rubbing alcohol, but it was cheaper not to denature it, and the hospitals used to get pure ethanol. I don't know if they still do, but you could take that and make some wild drinks out of it.
Which I think they did do on the program called MASH. WS2S, K2RIZ, is very cool.
I used to use the isopropyl alcohol for cleaning the heads on VCRs and any kind of electronic equipment. But I found that there was two different types of isopropyl alcohol. One was like 70% and the other one was 90%+. So the stronger one does work better. So I don't know if there's a difference there. So there's two different types of isopropyl alcohol. I mean, you know, when you buy it in like Walgreens, you look at the bottles and you'll see one is a lot less in percentage. Back either.
So you can buy isopropyl alcohol in Walgreens. I presume it's intended for cleaning up skin because you're about to do an injection. Is there more than one, two, or three kinds of alcohol that you could buy in a drugstore like Walgreens? Over to you, John. I mean, Paul, WS2N, K2IW.
I found that out. You know, I skipped the numbers. I think one's 70%, the other one is 90-something. I could go downstairs and look at the one that I got. I always get the 90-plus. I read it in an article somewhere, probably some magazine years ago, and they said make sure you get the 95 or whatever it is, 97%, I forget the number. But, I always went by that. But yeah, you can walk into the store right now and you'll see there's two different numbers. What the health people use it for, I don't know. Thank you, Nick.
John, you said you got with your Volta's Aerostorm gadget that you put in front of your wind surge machine, you got a lot more performance out of methyl alcohol. Where did you go to buy methyl alcohol, John? Go ahead.
No, Dick, not methyl. Ethyl, like the woman's name. Ethyl alcohol, like ethanol.
Okay, where did you buy that?
I had a friend of mine pick it up from a medical supply at a whole gallon of it. I think it was like $6.
So it's not sold in a drugstore, is what you're saying? This is an industrial product?
Yes, it's illegal to sell. Ethanol, you're not allowed to buy that because it's, you know, you can make liquor out of it, man. That's 200 proof.
Is that the stuff they, in theory, were using in Korea as depicted in the television program called MASH? Over to you, John.
That's the stuff. That's what they were using. The government still has, you know, drums of ethyl alcohol that they use for that purpose because to have it denatured costs more money and they wanted to do it cheap. So, yeah, that's what they were drinking. They had to cut it, of course, because it's like Everclear, which is 186 proof. You can't even drink that. It'll set fire to your throat.
Now, when they denature alcohol, I think I've asked you before and I've already forgotten the answer. What is the denature? Is that a other substance you add to the alcohol to make double down sure that people will not be drinking it? Over here, John.
Yes, it is toxic, and it has almost the exact same boiling point, so it's very hard to distill. Now, when you buy mouthwash, that's ethanol, and they have to put all of that chemical in there that you're able to digest without it making you sick. But alcoholics buy mouthwash and drink it and get stoned on that too, because I think that's like 70% alcohol.
Does mouthwash contain any other kind of substance that would be tough on your digestive tract? Go ahead.
Usually it has a lot of peppermint in it at such levels, which you could rinse your mouth out, but if you swallow it, it'll irritate your stomach and the lining of the esophagus, I believe, too. I wish Dr. Roy was around. We could get some great information. I'm sure he knows all about it.
Yeah, if he's like the rest of humanity, he's watching the debate. And I think the debate goes on for an hour and a half. So it must be getting close to winding down if they're not going overtime. And you know damn well they're going overtime. Okay. Is that the end of the mailbag, John, or do you have another one? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, that was it, Dick. That's the end of the mailbag. And I want to thank everybody for the questions. Good stuff. And let's go over to Paul and see what he's got for us. KC2WGB.
82CBB.
Go ahead, Todd.
I have probably just learned something tonight. Not to bother to wait for the repeater tail to drop. I am not going to ask about arcing. I am not going to ask about the alcohol. Although I knew a Nimrod who actually drank the drugstore alcohol and he had heartburn, like you would believe. And yes, John, the rubber restore, find it, let me know, I'm looking for something. So, actually, I have an antenna hookup connection, and I'd like Dick's opinion, if that's all right.
Fire away, Todd.
Okay. I'm running out of connections for the antenna switch. Now I have a 440 machine, a 220 machine, and I happen to have a triplex. And the antenna is a tri-band, so it covers 200, 220, 440. And I was just thinking, okay, if I take that position on the switch and run into a triplexer, one branch will go to 440, the 440 radio, and the 220 will go to the 220 radio. And I don't think that would be a problem. You know, when you transmit, I don't think it would go down the other path. The 2 meter leg, I think it might be a good idea just to throw a little, you know, dummy load on the end of that leg, because I'm not going to be using that. And I don't particularly see a problem with that. The radios go, I think the maximum is something like 50 watts. So I just wanted your opinion on that. Would I even need a dummy load? I think that would be prudent. So, any ideas?
If the dummy load, if the triplexer was properly designed, it has a common port. It's got a port that outputs the intended for, let's say, 2 meters. It's got a port that's output for, let's say, 220. And it's got a port that's output for 450. If you put a signal on the common port of any of those three frequencies, a properly designed triplexer puts all of its energy out of the appropriate port only. When you're on 220, energy will come out of the 220 port and not out of the 144 or the 450. So, should you put a demi load on there? You don't have to. On top of that, even if you use the connector thoroughly open circuited, and even if it did put some energy on that connector, it can't go anywhere. The average female connector, PNC, UHF, SO239, whatever, they're amazingly well shielded. It's an extremely poor antenna. Until you get up to 10 gigahertz, and you're not going there. Yeah, I can do a little bit of transmitting by the center pin of an SMA connector at 10 gigahertz, but not at 450. That's extremely well shielded. So if you're worried about energy coming out, and it can't do that. And as I said, if the triplexer is well designed, there is no energy there on the wrong frequency. Now, are there, let me drop it. Are there poorly designed triplexers out there, duplexers, triplexers, and whatever, which put some energy on the unused port? Maybe so. That's a properly designed one. All the energy comes out the right port. Now, if you're on 144, and the second harmonic of 144 is 288, now, even that's too far away from 220. Now, you can't even explain it that way. And the third harmonic of 144 does come out 450. I'll admit that. However, a reasonable transmitter is not putting out very much third harmonic energy. So I don't think you've got to terminate the unused port. Do it if you want to be double darn sure. I don't think you're doing anything beneficial when you do it. Over to you, Todd, K2LAW.
Just make sure if you do terminate, use a termination which can withstand that power that you're going to put onto it. If it's 50 watts, you're going to need 50 watt of termination.
Hold on now, John. If he's on 220, for instance, at 50 watts, any reasonable design triplexer is only going to put out microwatts out of the other two connectors. Over to you, John.
You're absolutely right, but if he inadvertently switches over to the 2 meter band and he only has, say, a, you know, 5 watt dummy load on it, he's going to blow it.
Good point. You got it, John.
Well, what I was going to ask, and by the way, I even listened to the TV antenna thing too. I did a whole report on TV stations, my God, back in like 1970. The thing that I was going to say, so to double check it, is say hook up the 440 radio, check the 220 with a, say, watt meter, and key up at 50. And if that thing moves, then I know I got a poorly designed triplexer. And then I guess I could also check the 2 meter. And of course check the other way around with the 220, and then I would know if the triplexer is designed well or if it's one of those cheapo things that just happens to work. And that would cover John's point right there. And that would tell me what I need to know.
Do you already own that triplexer? And are you about to run some of those experiments that Todd go ahead?
Oh God, I got so much crap going on right now. I haven't even done this. I'm probably not going to get to it until maybe next week, if at the earliest. But I figure gathering the information before I do anything is always just, you know, might look a little better. So, you know, I haven't even hooked anything up to test it yet. I know I have the triplex. I have to dig it out and see what happens. But, I'm just gathering the information. There's nothing I hate worse than hooking up something and finding out it doesn't work. I'd rather have all the stuff at my fingertips before I do it.
Very fine, Todd. Okay. I think it's time to go over to space report number 222. 222. Fire away, Apollo. WS2N. K2LIW.
This is WS2N.
Yeah, 222. This week, a few days ago, Blue Origin ran a test. Blue Origin is a company that launches these New Shepard rocket and spacecraft combined from West Texas. And they've done this with this particular rocket 4 different times. And then they bring it back and it lands vertically. It goes up, the spacecraft itself, the unmanned spacecraft, separates. And it does make it into space, but there's suborbital flights. And then I think parachutes down. And then the booster itself comes down and lands vertically on the, on the desert floor. No problem. 4 times in a row. And this time they ran an abort test. They wanted to, for any kind of flight that's eventually going to be manned, they need to run an abort test. So they did that successfully. And what they do is they launch the rocket and the spacecraft. They use the B-3 engine. It's a 110,000 pound engine, liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. And this time they went to maximum Q. And maximum Q is the highest pressure between the atmosphere and the speed. The highest maximum dynamic pressure that's exerted on a vehicle. And they get to that point, which was about 40 seconds after launch. And then they duplicate the explosion of a booster. So if a crew was on board, especially this will be manned, we will have 6 passengers, 2 crew members in the future. But what they do is separate the spacecraft from the booster. And spacecraft did that successfully. I saw it live. Blue Origin had it on their website. And the spacecraft came down perfectly. And the booster was expected. They really thought it was going to, kick over to the side with the solid booster rocket that launched the separation of the 2 spacecraft. It pushes out 70,000 pounds per square inch, and they thought that would affect the booster. So they weren't really counting on saving the booster. But they said if it did survive and land again vertically, they were going to retire it and put it into a museum somewhere. And that's exactly what happened. So that was pretty neat. Hopefully in the future, within a year or so, they probably will start testing with a crew of two, and then probably 6 months to a year after that, they'll start having paid passengers get onto the new Shepard. And now this is the same company that plans on eventually having orbital flights, and I talked about that a couple of weeks ago. And that's a bigger rocket called the New Blend. But that went off okay. And then I wanted to talk about Orbital ATK's launch that's coming up. It's supposed to go up tonight, which is tiny. So I made the announcement last week that it would be going off during the net, but it's been delayed, and I think they were thinking possibly at the time that hurricane might have been coming up here a little bit and causing 20 problems in Virginia, where it takes off from Wallops Island. So I think because of that, they delayed it, and it will go off this coming week on the 13th. And it should be a night flight. It's going to be 9:13 at night, which means that if there's nothing southeastern view, you might be able to see the thing take off. Be able to see the light of the rocket. Goes about 15 degrees above the horizon, so anywhere from New York and all the way down to Washington, D.C. might have a chance of seeing it. And then the reason it gets up to 15 degrees is it's going out over the ocean and, really heading west, so you're not going to see it get any higher than that. And then they should see it all the way to when it goes over the horizon. And they'll have a main engine cutoff, and it'll continue on. It's called the Antares rocket. And this time that they're launching with a brand new engine. The last time it was launched from Wallops Island was 2 years ago, this October, 2014. Been launched from their two launch facilities, their launch pad, so it's called Zero A. And they'll be launching from that rebuilt facility. That's what happened with 2 years ago. They launched an Antares rocket with the older engines that they're not going to use anymore, the older Russian engines. And it had blown up, shortly after launch, destroying the Cygnus spacecraft, which was the cargo that was going up to the International Space Station. Again, this is another Cygnus flight on top of Antares. They'll have the Cygnus. Now it's an enhanced Cygnus, so it's a longer cylinder and heavier and carries a lot more cargo than the older version. And they haven't been inactive in the last 2 years. Well, the Orbital ATK has this multi-billion-dollar contract with NASA to supply the space station. So what they were doing, let me drop it. They made a deal with the United Launch Alliance, which is really Boeing and Lockheed is part of this United Launch Alliance group that launches all the Atlas rockets from either California or from Florida, or the Delta rockets, the Delta 2s, pretty much everything for NASA. They made a deal with ULA to launch the two Cygnus spacecraft, so they put it into their fairing on an Atlas V, and they did that, roughly about 6 months apart from one another. And that was done in this last two-year period. That was while back with the old engines, from the last launch from Wallops Island, and they changed out the engine. Now they have a new one called an RD 181. It's still a Russian engine, but completely different than the old ones, and much more powerful. So they lift up the new enhanced Cygnus spacecraft. So let me drop it. This is WS2N. Talked about the oxygen generators and the reproduction of water and oxygen on board the space station last week. So I looked into it, went back to my old notes, and they do reaction machine on the Tranquility Mine. Exhaled carbon dioxide and hydrogen that's in the air, and they combine that and they get water out of it. And the way they get all the oxygen on the space station is through electrolysis, and they have plenty of panels, like we discussed last week, plenty of power, 200 kilowatts roughly. So plenty of power to spare. They run electrolysis and they duplicate, you know, they'll take any water that they have and separate it into oxygen and hydrogen. So what they used to do before the saboteur unit, they used to take the hydrogen and just dump it overboard, and that all had to be replaced from Earth. But nowadays they don't do that. They combine the hydrogen with the carbon dioxide, the exhaled carbon dioxide on board the station, and they combine that into water. And there is some hydrogen that's half of that hydrogen is left over, so they still do jump that. So there is they still replenish some hydrogen on board the space station. It's not a complete closed loop yet, but they're close to it. And since the saboteur machine has been on board, they've replenished about 10,000 pounds of oxygen, half the amount of probably about 5.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Good. So they expect to make 2,000 pounds of oxygen every year now on board with that machine. Let me drop it. Plenty more topics, but I'm just going to mention the shuttle launch vehicle. I've talked about that in the past. It's a large plane. The wingspan is it'll be the biggest wingspan ever out of any plane ever made in the world, and that's being developed out in California. And it's a carrier plane, and the idea is to carry rockets. And they've made an agreement with Orbital ATK, the same company that launches the Antares out of Wallops Island, Virginia. I talked about earlier, that same company also launches the Pegasus rockets. Pegasus, they've launched 40 or 50 of these things over the years, and they usually use the Lockheed L 1011 plane as a carrier plane to launch the Pegasus. Drop it. But now they'll keep doing that with some of the NASA flights. But this new plane that I was talking about, that's the carrier plane, Strato Launcher, will be carrying now orbital Pegasus rockets in the future. And they'll be able to launch light payload satellites into any kind of orbit you want, because now you have an airplane. You can go where you can go on the equator, you can do polar, you can do 98 degree sun synchronous orbits, anything you want with this new plane that should be ready. Probably, I think they're going to run a test flight next year, early next year. See how that goes. A couple other topics, but I'm not going to cover them at this time. Dick, we'll turn it back to you. K2RIW, WS2N.
Before I proceed, let's see if anyone who has listened to the first half, so to speak, of the space report, if you have any questions or any fills on what Paul has said so far, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW listening. Okay, Paul, you're right now getting oxygen that the astronauts are breathing from at least two sources. One is to do electrolysis of water where water gets separated when you pass current through it, of hydrogen and oxygen. And by the way, when you do electrolysis on the Earth, the hydrogen bubbles up through the water on one of the test tubes, the oxygen bubbles up through the water on the other test tube. And that bubbling up takes place because we got local gravity. On the International Space Station, it don't have local gravity. So how in the world do they do that bubble-up process as part of the electrolysis? That's question number one. Do they have to put it into a miniature centrifuge of some kind to make the electrolysis work? That's question number one. Question number two, let me drop it. That they also take the carbon dioxide the astronauts are exhaling, and they take the excess hydrogen left over from the electrolysis process, and somehow they're taking the carbon dioxide through, I guess, the saboteur, I think it's called. They do some kind of a process by which the oxygen as part of the carbon dioxide gets mixed with the hydrogen, and it makes water, and now you've got carbon left over. What do they do with that carbon? And what percentage of the carbon dioxide do they manage to separate this? I mean, maybe only 80% of the carbon dioxide can they recover the oxygen. And what happens to the carbon? As you can tell, there's a whole lot of questions here. And so the electrolysis machine and the carbon dioxide processing machine, are they both the same machine, or are they two separate machines side by side? WS2N. Answer any of these any way you want to, Paul. WS2N, because as you can tell, I really don't know much about this. K2ISW, you got it, Paul. Paul,
yeah, I know the Russians have the electrolysis as well. That's fine. And if you look at a picture of it, it looks like it's about, I'd say about 3 foot high and probably 1 foot in diameter. Electrolysis machine. So what's inside and how they have it operating, I don't know. And your question really is the carbon. Now what do they do with that? And it crystallizes, apparently. It solidifies. So it's able to, I guess, in a very dense form. So I guess they don't have to worry too much about it. And they have the ability to clean their carbon where that goes. I guess they, you know, how much of it is really accumulated, I don't know. But yeah, that's the whole system. And there's another system that they're trying to develop, which will eventually close that loop and save the rest of the hydrogen and do something with the carbon. But I forget what that is. I forget the name of it. And it's supposed to be very heavy and a lot of power to operate that. So they're not there yet, but they're close. So yeah, they're taking the water, separating, just like you said, hydrogen and oxygen. Now you have the oxygen, instead of dumping the hydrogen, roughly half of that gets mixed with the carbon dioxide. And that turns itself back into water again. And then the carbon is, I believe, solidified, from what I read. So that's pretty much what they're doing. And if you look at
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Sounds like a tremendous amount of oxygen. So that's why they don't have to bring up as much supplies as they used to. They used to bring a lot of stuff up with the shuttle. Before the saboteur thing was up there, I think 5 or 6 years ago, maybe longer now. 2007. Let me drop it 1 second. But that's about it. I don't have any further information on that. The chemistry behind it is about the closest I can get to what I've read, without getting into the real molecular parts of things. And I know they had some problems with the saboteur machine in the beginning. They were constantly fixing it. But from my own understanding, the last couple of years, they've got it running good. So, have them over here. Gonna stay up, put it in that, naturally responded that it's too late. So he told me to say hello to everybody out there. I think he's gonna be a future ham. Back to you, Dick WS.
On the next transmission, you should tell us your grandson's name. You got oxygen that the astronauts are breathing from at least two sources. One, hydrolysis of water, and two, the conversion of carbon dioxide back into water and carbon. And to use either of those machines live while the astronauts are breathing it wouldn't make me feel comfortable. I want some excess oxygen around somewhere. So I'm sure you got a bunch of bottles of oxygen, compressed oxygen, in bottles somewhere on that space station. But of all the oxygen that they're getting by way of electrolysis and the conversion of carbon dioxide, are they taking that oxygen and pumping it into a high-pressure bottle? Or are they just using it live? I'd like to believe they can build oxygen faster than the astronauts are using it, and the excess is being pumped by way of all the 200 kilowatts of power. You could easily run a pump and pump it into a high-pressure bottle of some kind, a container. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
Yeah, what a big 6,000-pound square-inch bottle. And they loaded them down here on Earth. And there were quite a few people involved in doing that. All kinds of safety involved. Nobody was allowed to near these things when they were getting filled up. Remember reading the story about them. And after they were loaded, he would put them onto SpaceX and set them up. And that's, you know, how they got some of the excess oxygen that they need up there that they were getting low on. They used to do it all the time with the space shuttle. And of course, that's gone. If you look at the outside of the space station on the Quest module, they have big round tanks. I mean, these things look like, they got to be 5 feet in diameter. They got to be maybe 10 feet long. And there's probably about 10 of these things. And I think like 6 of them are oxygen and the other 4 are nitrogen. And these are all spare oxygen and nitrogen tanks that they primarily use, you know, they're really there for all the EVAs that they do. You know, you do an EVA and they have to resupply the Quest lab every time you pull a vacuum on it. But it's so much. I mean, they brought up so much. They leave it up there, and that can replenish the air on the station if need be, if we drop it. So between that and what the Russians have too, they have that, and they also have these candles. They call, I think, they call them candles. You can light them. They're solid tanks. Kind of look like fire extinguish tanks, but I think they're white, and you can ignite these things, and they let off oxygen for emergency. But each tank is good for one person for one day or something. So you know, you would go through a lot of these if you needed to have a problem. They used them on board Mir. They came in handy when they had some problems on Mir. And my grandson's name is James. So, loves science. Like those Mr. Wizard things. You know, remember Mr. Wizard? And you can now get them on Netflix, the old shows. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
WS2MMC.
I think it was W2MMC. Start off with your name, sir, and go right ahead with your question. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
So, Dick, the handle here is Terry, Tango, Echo, Romeo, Romeo, Yankee. I just put this repeater in, I just wanted to see if I was making it. The call sign is Killer Charlie 2, Mike Charlie. Good evening.